Welcome everyone to a very special episode of the Religious Studies Project Roundtable. Very special episode, not that somebody died, but that somebody has returned. With us we have Roundtable regular Kevin Whitesides.
Returned Roundtable regular.
Coming from California on his honeymoon and decided to spend his honeymoon doing a roundtable with us.
Actually, I think you decided that I would be doing that on my honeymoon.
Well, we missed you terribly.
So now that Ethan has made the usual preamble, what we're actually here to discuss is that, effectively, as we've been discussing a lot on the RSP recently, we are witnessing the death of the world religion's paradigm, which creates an interesting vacuum that kind of became apparent to us during the conference at the EESR at Liverpool, in that, where does credibility come from? If you think about it, the world's religion paradigm has been the benchmark for what has been credible scholarship within religious studies. As long as you're working within that paradigm, you're doing credible work. If you're outside that paradigm, the credibility of your work kind of becomes in question. So now that we're losing this paradigm, where are we going to get our sources of credibility from? So, that is the reason why we are here to discuss. So, as my co-editor has mentioned already, we have the returned roundtable regular, Kevin Whitesides. Would you like to say hello again?
Hello again. Kevin Whitesides, and I'm just about to start a PhD at the University of California, Santa Barbara, looking at contemporary New Age networks.
And moving on to his left, we have Liam.
I am Liam Sutherland. I am starting the first year of a PhD in Edinburgh University, looking at religion and Scottish national identity.
And then we have David.
Yeah, do y'all know who I am? And I've nearly finished my PhD. I'm about to no longer be free and easy, but one of those people that complains about the fact that there's no jobs all the time. And on my left,
it's Christopher Cotter, who is at Lancaster University, but one of the Edinburgh regulars and one of the RSP dudes. And he is a year into his PhD, and it is all going super duper.
Super duper.
I'm Ethan Quillen. I've just started my third year PhD at the University of Edinburgh, and I'm reading a lot of Ian McEwan. And I'm the atheism guy.
So. And I'm Jonathan Tuckett, and I'm also going into the third year of my PhD at the University of Stirling, and I'm studying phenomenology and social science.
And so, computer games.
And computer games.
Computer games.
Studying computer games.
Which actually is a good way to start this conversation about credibility. I'm well aware that David is afraid that this is going to be about blowing my own trumpet. But I'm not, because actually this is part of the reason why this topic came to mind in the first place. Because as we were recording the Christmas special for the RSP, David and I were kind of joking about the fact that I studied video games and religion. And I noticed certain reactions from certain prominent members of the BESR and the EESR, and they were a little bit confused and couldn't quite take it seriously that that was what I studied. And part of the reason I think that is because we're still hooked up on this old paradigm of what makes certain studies credible. So, as a first opening gambit question, nothing to do with video games whatsoever, if we have no standard of credibility left, how do we go about starting or setting up a new standard? Where do we start to look for it?
Well, there's one obvious thing to say, which is that you have to define or reconceptualize what the thing you're studying is. Mm-hmm. Part of the problem is that we're religious studies or studies on religion or whatever the department is called. So if you can define what religion is or what religious is, then it's easy to delineate. So if one of you could just tell us what religion is, then we can be done with this.
Yeah. I'll go to the non-religion guy to explain that one.
I see. Well, I take a relational approach and look at the usage of categories, etc., by people. And that seems to be the way that a lot of us, maybe, and a lot of the discipline is going, is sort of getting around that by saying, well, we're studying the usage of things being described as religious and things set apart as religious by people. We're studying those sort of discursive moves or study.
I find it interesting that you said getting around. Yeah. Mm. I mean, I similarly use a discursive methodology, but I don't see it as getting around so much. I don't think there's anything to get around.
Mm. No, yeah.
I suspect that the problem is there's nothing really to define. Rather, there's just ways of talking about the world.
Yeah, and I also think that we always get a bit hung up on religious studies having this difficulty, I imagine, and we're not in another discipline, but I imagine that other disciplines, you know, maybe there's a bit more consensus, but if people just aren't quite as obsessed, maybe, with defining what is gender studies, political science, and that sort of thing. But.
Well, von Stuckrad kind of mentions that, about the idea that the other disciplines don't spend as much time worrying about the terms they use.
Mm.
And I always found that sort of as a... I think he's sort of using it as sort of a benign critique of it. I think, I can't remember exactly what he says, but he mentioned something about, you know, there's more of a laid-back, I think is what he says. There's a laid-backness to the way that other disciplines will use the terms that they're talking about. Which I think is problematic for us, because... Mm. If we take a laid-back sort of way of talking about religion, then we don't need to worry so much about what we mean by religion when we talk about religion and religious studies.
Mm.
I think it becomes problematic for our department. And I think we're sort of special in that way. I don't know if you guys would agree with any of that, but...
Well, I just feel that actually, in some cases, yes, religious studies can be ridiculous in its hand-wringing over definition. But in some cases, at least being clear and at least thinking about it is actually an advantage. Rather than just treat it, we're very careful to not treat religion as an object or as something which is like an essence that has one set of characteristics. So, for example, like I'm sort of going into what might be called nationalism studies, and I feel that that's something that other disciplines could actually learn from, be more reflexive, be more aware that they are constructing categories that classify vast groups of people, and sometimes they need to be careful about the implications.
Kind of leaping up on that point, in a sense, does religious studies have any credibility whatsoever? Because you have Liam here just saying that I'm going into nationalism studies. So really, our own contribution to social science and the general academic world is to instill a sense of reflexiveness. But if all we've got to contribute is this sense of reflexiveness, as Ethan is saying, then why do we need to be in religious studies departments? I mean, this is part of the question about the credibility, if you think about it, is... Credibility is also part of what makes a discipline a discipline.
Well, it's not, you know, to jump on in front of Liam before he gets going, but the whole idea of credibility, and I just came back from a conference in Oxford, the British Society of Philosophy of Religion, not to deride them in any way, but I noticed that there is a very large lack of sort of religious studies style discussion about religion. And it was a conference on atheism or atheisms.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seemed very interesting to sort of sit through presentations that didn't begin with, let me really quick stipulate what I mean by atheism, or counter to that, theism and or just religion. And atheism was used, as it always is, sort of used recently as a very general term to mean a rejection or a denial of any supernatural belief. So it was very broadly defined, but it just seemed very interesting to hear non-religious studies discussions. And one example I'm sort of sharing with everybody is one individual talking about how people who participate in religious rituals, such as the Eucharist, they're just sort of self-deluding themselves in a philosophical sort of way, and that they really know that this isn't real, and that the host isn't the actual body and blood of Christ, but they just do it anyway because it's what makes them religious. And I just found it very interesting that it was very, very casual, very cavalier, which I think is what demarcates us as very different, that we take the time to be a pain in the ass about what we mean when we talk about such and such.
We're also aware that we're studying human beings, and you know, I think a religious scholar or an anthropologist, not just religious scholars, but an anthropologist or a religious scholar would, you know, just ask themselves, well, how do I know that these people don't really consider this to be real? What right do I actually have to say that? I mean, do I have any good evidence to back that up? I mean, if there is good evidence, but I don't think in a lot of cases there are. I think I've met many people that make these kind of assumptions, you know, that it can be explained away, that people don't really believe or really consider it to be true, if you don't like the term belief, but you know.
Well, I like that you brought up belief, because hopefully we'll get back to that after we sort of tackle the first topic we're on, the idea of belief and whether it's our job to say that somebody believes or that we should be interested in belief in general. And this came up as well, one of the keynote addresses at the ASR, the idea of belief versus action, et cetera, et cetera. So.
I just wanted to stick in with the credibility for a moment. I guess it depends how you define credibility. we're talking there about departments, you know, like why are there religious studies departments? And I mean, what I find really nice about religious studies is that you have a whole different range of disciplinary approaches, but it's sort of focused on a central. There's a shared vague idea of what the subject matter is. You know, we all have some sort of common frame of reference and things that we can talk about. Should it be a discipline? The thing I've said before is more of a sort of field of interest rather than a discipline. It's, you've got these different disciplinary approaches, and then we all center around this sort of central topic, which we then try and define. Whether that is legitimate enough to have its own department, I don't know. It seems quite fruitful, yeah. The departments that do exist. That you have conversations that I don't think would... Obviously, if we were in, say, sociology, and you were doing sociology of religion, you would have conversations with other sociologists, but you wouldn't necessarily have that interdisciplinarity of speaking to other people who are working with your, say, broad topic. And I'm using that topic in quite a sort of general term, but... is the way that universities organize their departments the best way to judge credibility? I don't know.
No.
But in a sense, the credibility question is about university organizations. I mean, you're right, credibility is as much as religion is, this vague notion. But if you think about it, if a discipline can say, I am a credible discipline, that assures it, or should assure it, a place in a university setting. So if... going back to the world religions paradigm, if we are abandoning that, are we in a sense potentially removing ourselves from the university in the sense that we are taking away our credibility, so we are taking away the our reason for being a distinct department within the university?
Why does it require having the world religions paradigm to be credible?
It doesn't.
To be understood to be credible by a university. It seems to me there's plenty of university departments that are setting up programs that are entirely not based on the world religions paradigm, whether they be cognitive or whatever, that are fully supported by the university. In some ways, because they're considered to be moving in a more credible way, because they're adopting sort of standards that are widely considered credible within academia. Well, at the same time as there's, I mean, it almost seems like a non-issue. There's been plenty of work that's entirely credible that's been done under the rubric of the world religions paradigm, and there's continues to be plenty of credible work done by religious studies scholars, whether, and that credibility, as Chris is sort of pointing towards, is going to have a lot to do with what the particular methodology they employ. So if they're doing history of religions, then it's going to be their credibility is going to be largely based on whether they apply historical standards of methodology or whether they do their cognitive psychology properly based on this. So I think lots of people are doing credible work. Lots of people have been doing credible work, and lots of people are doing work that's not that good, and that's going to continue as it always has.
In a sense, the world religions paradigm is a historical fact. It's just it's the paradigm that we've grown up with. We could have grown up with another paradigm. I think the point here is that we're trying to shift out of that paradigm, and what happens when you try and shift out. I'm not necessarily saying that religious studies is bad. We could come up with a new paradigm, but I mean, there's that awkward transition period where everything's not quite clear, because I disagree with you with what you were just saying about the whole universities branching out in terms of approaches. I don't think that many universities are doing it. I mean,
Luther Martin,
Luther Martin and Don Weeb are announcing the Levener project, which is going on in the Czech Republic, which is the first cognitive science specific department of its kind. It's the first in the world. they mention a couple of other departments. But when you look at like the advertisements that are coming through from universities for academic positions, they are at least still thinking in the world's religions paradigms.
Yeah.
In the sense that you're getting positions offered in Judaism and Islam and Christianity.
In fact, to some degree, that's getting worse. I mean,
yes, exactly.
But I mean, what if people want to study Judaism or Islam or Christianity?
How much of this is based on a public perception? By public, I mean the university perception of what you study when you study religion. And it's the sort of basic standard that you study Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, indigenous religions.
Or,
and for myself and possibly Chris, though he's sort of a little, better option there. But I'm completely outside of the world religions paradigm.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have sort of a field. But this seems to be something that's coming up in departments as well. That sticks specifically to the...
But yeah, so there's more, and it might happen slowly because there's a lot to sort of overcome, but there's more departments that, I mean, we have Steve Sutcliffe here doing New Age stuff, and like, I'm working with Ann Taves at UCSB in a cognitive science emphasis group. They're coming in, it's going to take a while, but I don't think that means we need to get rid of people who are studying Islam or Christianity.
Is this really something we need to worry about? Do we need to get rid of the world religions paradigm, or is it just sort of going to develop and evolve on its own? And we're making a lot of noise about something because we see it's difficult to get a position teaching such and such and such and such. And also from just this group here, we're all doing, our dissertations are all very sort of broad and very different ways outside the world religions paradigm. We're not just basically studying some
that's the
Jewish
funny thing.
Sect or something. You know?
I don't. Is there anyone around this table that would actually fit into the world religions paradigm? I don't think so.
Yeah.
I've mostly been theory. I'm now going on to religion in Scotland. David is doing conspiracy milieu UFO
to
stuff.
The degree that I am very much outside of the world religions paradigm, I've never felt like I've come up against any barriers that have stopped me from doing my work.
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, we're treading a little bit on... Sort of, we had the After the World Religions Paradigm podcast and stuff, so I'm aware that I might be repeating some stuff, but it comes down a lot of this to what do people want to study when they come to study religious studies at an undergraduate level? What does the public at large think religious studies is? And I think in both those cases it's...
And we should probably add into that what the universities want us to study.
It's world religions, world religions, world religions, and it's, you know, this is a broad generalization, but it's only when you start to get to the sort of higher level of undergraduate, master's, PhD that you get, you know, people actually thinking, you know, I want to go outside this, I want to explore theoretical issues, methodological issues, and things which are a bit outside that paradigm. But most people, and therefore most teaching positions, most lectureships, etc., want world religion.
Well, I think that's also, I think that suffers a lot of a general, I don't know if I want to say misconception, but a general sort of assumption that we know what every department of religious studies or study of religion does. There's no way in hell that anyone around this table can know what every department around the world does.
Of course not.
So we come up with this idea that, oh, well, all of our colleagues are having trouble getting a job because they're not subject area specific. I don't teach Judaism 101. I don't teach Christianity 101. And I especially don't teach it compared to all the other ones that are out there. So I think it's sort of the very general idea that, you know, the world religions paradigm is horrible and evil because we don't specifically just teach on that area. And I think part of the issue is just that we, you know, we just assume a little bit too much.
I am starting to think, I mean, I do critique the simplistic version of the world religions paradigm myself, but I am starting to think that among some scholars it's become a kind of construction of its critics, not an actual thing that anyone's actually... I don't know if anyone has ever actually stood up and said, you know, religion should just be Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, and so on. You know, and I think sometimes when people are critiquing the world religions paradigms, they actually sometimes mean different things. Like, I've heard people, when they're critiquing the world religions paradigm, they're talking about an essentialist approach to religion. At other times, they're just saying, you know, taking traditions as monochrome things or even being focused on the major religions. So people, I think, need to know what they're... Even you need to set up a model of what are you critiquing, what are you reacting against, because I think sometimes it becomes just a kind of... Not even a straw man. A straw man would be something specific. It becomes a kind of ghost, you know, a spectre, to go back to Marx.
Oh, okay, in that case, let's assume world religion's paradigm is a straw man. Let's not talk about that for now, because during what you were saying, we were just mentioning how people's expectations of ourselves, our students' expectations, and then the university's expectations is the problem that we're experiencing. When I raise, perhaps I'm raising a non-issue by talking about credibility, but is the issue stemming from you have different people with different expectations? Mm-hmm. So is there anything we can do to reconcile that?
Mm.
I sort of wonder if that's different in any other field. I mean, I've, like, especially as an undergraduate, I moved around a lot between different sort of sciences and psychology, and pretty much every field I've ever been into, the professors in that field bemoan the general state of knowledge about that field and point out all of the ways that people misunderstand that field and expect it to be something that it's not, whether it's physics or psychology or any of these other things. I wonder if that's just a sort of perpetual problem that people don't understand what is going on in academia at these levels.
On top of that, I'd like to sort of ask a question. You know, will we ever get to the point where when we teach academically, we're not going to be teaching sort of one-on-one courses? David, I'm going to use an example. I'm going to blow David's trumpet here. Was it? Toot your own trumpet or something? David's doing a PhD on conspiracy theory, milieu, and discourses, and sort of the demythologization of sort of UFO, etc. I'm butchering it, but that's, you know, basic understanding of what the world thinks of David Robertson. He's also teaching a course on New Testament. And it's not that he's not qualified. He's more than qualified to teach that. And are we all going to have to get to that point anyway? Because it's just the way it is when you take it. When you're an undergraduate and you're, you know, a sophomore or a second year and you're undergraduate and you decide you're going to start doing religious studies as a major, you sort of have to take these intro courses. They just will exist.
Absolutely.
And I don't remember exactly who it was that wrote the article. Chris, I know Chris will know about the sort of world religion paradigm. Was it Suzanne or...
Suzanne, Time for Change.
Yes, and there was a comment on there on, I think it was on a blog post about it, where a gentleman came on and discussed, well, this is the way I'm teaching world religions when I have to teach that basic 101 course. Yeah. And instead of just saying, this is Judaism, these are what people do.
Stephen Ramey.
Might have been. This is Christianity, this is what people do. Rather, we look at the textbooks that you have to buy that are just sort of the standard, everyone publishes the world religions paradigm textbook. Mm-hmm. And we look at how different aspects of that religion are being described discursively by those textbooks. So instead of just saying, this is Islam, five pillars, et cetera, this is how this person is defining it. This person is defining it. Mm-hmm. So as we discuss how it's being defined, we're actually at the same time defining it in general.
Mm-hmm. There's comparisons to other fields, though. I mean, for all that we're saying, are we the only field that's this sort of self-analytic? I'm not sure that that's true. I mean, a good example is art.
Yes.
Where from probably at least the turn of the 19th century into the 20th century, maybe even earlier, there was a definite move away from seeing as the study of the classical form of art into an ongoing dialogue about what art is. And in fact, most of the celebrated artworks of our day are things which challenge the boundaries of what you count as art in one way or another. Another example might be psychology, which maybe psychoanalysis is maybe a better example, in that it started off as one particular methodology and understanding of studying the psyche, but over time has rejected a lot of the methodology and assumptions which it was based on and become more of a discourse about how we construct the psyche, what is the psyche, how did, you know. So that's possibly what's happened in our discipline, and we are a young discipline, so so is that necessarily a bad thing?
Well, no, even related to that, study of literature has sort of undergone, you know, there was a period where literature studies was dead, you know, studying literature was just a dead discipline, and it's still around, it's still doing what it does, and it's the same idea you're mentioning with art, sort of transition between modern and postmodern and then post-postmodern, et cetera, et cetera. trying to redefine itself in order to make sense of why it exists.
Very quickly, we could maybe adopt the sort of art critical thing and see, you know, instead of saying it's good, but is it art? Maybe we should have, well, it's meaning, but is it religion?
Yeah, I was just going to say, sort of, again, with the word religious paradigm, that I've never seen, even people that are very, very critical of it, I've never seen anyone who doesn't sympathise with, well, you've got to teach religion somehow, and you've got to teach, you know, almost everyone's jumped into teaching one of these intro to religion courses. So I've never actually seen anyone say, you know, you shouldn't be teaching that at all, because I think everyone actually kind of has to at some point teach that kind of thing.
If only there was a book which discussed those kind of issues, Chris.
Well, it would be amazing. Just like from my experience of my fiance's doing a PhD in chemistry, and I remember, you know, first year high school chemistry, you know, they start off, they show you those wee diagrams of the atoms look like this, there's an electron going around here.
Yeah.
And then you go up a couple of years and then they say, no, actually, you know, that was just a way to help you understand, it's actually like this. And that's happened to her pretty much every year, right throughout undergraduate, master's, and into PhD, that you get to a stage where it's like, well, actually, that simplistic understanding doesn't work. And maybe, you know,
like initiation of the esoteric orders. At the top order, they say, there is no chemistry.
Stephen Cohen described learning about physics as learning lies to then be replaced with more lies, which are slightly more true than the previous lies.
Yeah. So again, you get a start.
Which kind of, like, you can say that in physics, and people will kind of, like, you know, chortle and be like, okay, yeah, that's kind of true. You say that in religious studies, and people will probably be like, you've been lying to people about religion? What are you doing?
How do you make good citizens out of that?
And how do you make good citizens? Because this is the other question about credibility. Because if credibility is about what the public perceives of us and what we do, there is a shifting emphasis on publicly accessible forms of academia. And is that going to be a slightly different form of academia to what we're used to? In the sense that we have our academic journals, which are peer-reviewed, and then you have your credibility within those journals. But what you publish in a public forum isn't necessarily credible by that standard. Right. But universities are now shifting an emphasis towards these public forum styles of information.
Like podcasts.
What?
Not to say that the RSP is in no way incredible whatsoever.
Well, it is incredible.
But that's still not the standard of academic credibility, though.
True. Mm. Yes, true. You have this academic standard, but also at the same time you have the what we'll call the paymaster perspective on credibility.
Yeah.
And based on the current economic climate and all the situations that are going on, are we witnessing a situation in which our credibility is shifting more towards what the paymasters are saying rather than what our fellow academics are saying?
Yes.
Actually,
yes.
I have no idea.
Job done.
But the question, I suppose, is who should be deciding the usefulness of it? And I think it's a failure of the discipline as well, that we have failed to prove our usefulness at that kind of second-level discourse. And I think to some degree that the media is to blame in that they're not inviting an argument in which they have somebody who's a qualified critic of it.
We don't end up making iPads and Viagra based on our work, and so people don't care as much.
I'm just going to write that down.
At the same time, we're also not curing cancer.
iPads and Viagra.
I bet you more people care about iPads and Viagra.
We might be curing cancer from a Marxist point of view, but...
But I think part of what religious studies can offer and can continue to offer is going back to what David said, is the continuity of discourse. If we abolish religious studies, then that discourse is not going to continue in the same way. All of these people who have sort of been taking on this conversation is not going to happen the same way if it sort of dissolves out into different departments. And I think that's really valuable for us to be continuing that, because there's a lot of new ideas coming about and new sort of ways of analyzing, and we sort of have to let those get their legs at the same time as they're in conversation with what's come before.
But to throw your own comment back at you, can you put a price tag on those ideas? I mean, are the ideas that religious studies developing?
Theoretical physics departments are very well funded, and people like Lawrence Krauss and others will say my work is absolutely useless, other than that, like, I'm having fun playing around with math, and they give me lots and lots of money to do it.
Arguably,
so ultimately,
Lawrence Krauss is useless.
And he may be being disingenuous there.
No, he's actually not.
Sitting in his bag full of dollar bills.
No, the idea is that the...
Being serenaded by Richard Dawkins.
Oh, God.
Religion's...
No,
I did see a great slide of the ESR. I can't remember who had it, but it was the...
there was a playground?
There was a...
Oh. It was the park, right? It's where we're
head desk.
There was a few roundabouts and some arguments,
there was definitely, but there was a good... someone had the photo of Richard Dawkins with religion. Together they can find the cure.
I've told you all about the time in... discussing biblical studies, where it was a theology student said in front of a large room full of postgraduates, of which I was the only religious studies person there, although I don't think they realised that, said, the thing about religious studies is that they're all seekers, but we've already found.
Oh, for God.
To which my reply was, from our point of view, you're all the patients and we're the doctors.
Well, it's interesting, you bring up religious studies, or biblical studies, because...
It wasn't biblical studies, it was theology. Apologies, me, if you're listening.
This last week was induction week here at New College, and so we get in a big crop of new students. And usually when we
hear... Yeah, they're mostly rich chicks who think Buddhism's brilliant. Woo! USA!
All from the USA.
Which... unfortunately, goes back to the credibility thing. Who are we catering to? Are we catering to?
What the hell are you talking about?
But then it sounds like if I'm hearing Jonathan correctly, then what you'd want to do as a religious studies department is cater to those U.S. people who want to look at Buddhism, because that's where the money's coming in, and that's what people want to do. And like,
oh no, exactly. Yes.
But then are we just destroying the discipline at that point?
Well, no, because when you think about it, like, you have the paymaster credibility, but this is kind of like the client credibility, because when you do, and we're all postgrads doing religious studies presumably with an aim to being academics as a career, whereas not every single student who comes into an undergrad has that as their intention for doing religious studies. I mean, I was speaking with Tim Jensen in an interview that will be coming up soon, and he pointed out that
has recently been called
depending on when this has been broadcast.
We'll end it the right one.
Yeah.
How many people in other disciplines you have a larger, I'm sure in whatever discipline you have a much larger amount of undergraduates then move on to masters and PhD and
most other undergraduates, with the possible exception of psychology or something, actually are doing it for some sort of employability reason. I mean, there's a reason to get an undergraduate degree in physics or chemistry other than to become some sort of scholar. It's not necessarily a quest for personal meaning. It's just that, you know, having a hard science undergraduate degree will make you more attractive to employers in certain sectors. The same cannot really be said of religious studies.
Well, if you study Islam or something, you could get hired by...
Oh, sure,
state
not saying there are no jobs, but it's a different situation.
For the whole of the humanities. Really.
Yes, exactly.
Which is what
was not specific to us.
I was discussing with Tim. Should we be catering more to that? Should we be turning, if we're going to abandon the world religions paradigm, and I'm not going to actually discuss the paradigm itself, but if we abandon this paradigm, should we be teaching in a more accessible manner, in the sense that we are giving people something they can get a job with? Because right now, with religious study, because this is one of the selling points of religious studies in Britain, is that it's the best general degree. There's no, they don't list any vocation that can go with religious studies aside from, you know, religious studies teacher. So should we be tailoring religious studies more so that you can get a vocational job out of doing it at an undergrad level?
Well, I think that's sort of an individualistic responsibility. I think if we get PhDs in topics that are cool, we got a better chance of getting a job. You know, if you get a PhD in aliens, you're probably going to get a job because students will be like, I want to study aliens. Just like if you get a PhD in atheism, oh, I want to read Richard Dawkins. You know, you're going to have the opportunity to actually teach that. I'm not sure Liam and Kevin are going to do, but you know.
Buggered.
Yeah, I already taught a class about 2012 last semester.
Yeah, and it's dead, Kevin. Who's going to take a class in 2012 now?
There were people taking it.
2012 happened. It's now 2015.
I don't know. We still talk about the Branch Davidians. That happened way longer ago.
You call it 2012 : when prophecy fails, and you tie in the classic festing of material. You apply it to studying something that's in living memory of the students in the room. Boom! That's a good class.
And there's always going to be another.
You know,
the guy over here knows how to teach a class.
There's always going to be another failed prophecy to study.
Yeah.
And we still study all the old ones.
Not,
I think there is a balance to be had there. You want something that's sort of attractive and people are going to come in, but you also need to keep up the rest of that. You can't just only have the sexy classes because that's what the students want.
I was being sort of humorous about that.
But I think it's true. I think there's a certain degree to which you do have to sell yourself, but not at the expense of the rest of the discipline.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. We don't have to completely rewrite how we do it, but we can still market ourselves.
In a sense, you could kind of spin that on the head, talking about the idea of the paradigm thing and how part of the problem with the paradigm is that we teach it to undergrads, and then at master's level, we then have to go, we lied to you. It's all wrong. This is how you're supposed to do it.
I don't think it's quite as dramatic as that.
Yeah, I don't think that's
the way Jonathan does it.
Yeah, just treated it so well in his tutorial.
To be perfectly honest, I'm not buying in here at all, I feel we can actually draw people in with this material that they want to study and then use it as a means of packaging the stuff we want them to learn, which is, you know, how to criticize, how complicated the religions are, that kind of thing.
David is looking quite skeptical at this point, so I'm going to let him.
No, it's just, we can't let people study the things they want to.
But David has a good point, actually, because literally I have an email from a colleague who related the story of an anecdote of two students who came up to her at the end of the first class and said they didn't want to do this class anymore because it involved too much thinking. I mean,
God.
Well, yeah, Steve complains about that a lot as well.
These
students just aren't prepared to do all the work that you give them.
But that's always going to be true. There's a reason why the average grade is the average grade, and it's not a very good grade that most good students would kind of want to get, but that's what most students get because...
This is also what I think is sort of the ridiculous notion of, as you're saying, you know, from an undergraduate perspective, then you start your master's, and it's like, well, we've lied to you. No, there's a major difference between doing a postgraduate degree in religious studies and doing an undergraduate degree in religious studies, and I think that's probably the same thing with other disciplines as well. But when you're doing an undergraduate degree, you're doing the basic information on this is what, et cetera, et cetera, and there's lots of different ways to do that. When you get a master's and a PhD, you're specific to a certain type. You're basically not doing the, I want to go to a class and just learn about Buddhism, man. It's kind of fun. Mm-hmm. You just don't really do that anymore. Well, you're supposed to be geared for postgraduate study. You're supposed to master a topic.
Well, to go back to Chris's example, it's, you know, the undergraduate degree is here's the Rutherfordian atom. After that, it's, well, we know this is wrong, so you replace it.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, but this is the thing. Like, when we were at the EASR conference, people talking about the need to re-envisage religious studies with a new paradigm, part of their complaint about this was that we are in a sense lying to our students at the undergrad level. So can we stop lying to students? I mean,
what was this lying?
I don't think it's lying.
Simplification.
I introduced that.
I just don't think it's that. I mean, it's quite that black and white. I think it's just. I think another reason that scholars always go on about how much they hate the world religions paradigm is it's after studying religion for so long, it's too simplistic and it's boring to them. It's true.
You do have a really good time.
That's why, you know, people go...
I know professors who just, I got to teach a stupid class because they're just so tired of talking
about
it.
Well, that's why, you know, let's look at, like, if you go to a religious studies conference like the EASR, you've got papers. You've got papers on different religions, but always on some small aspect of one religion. Or, you know, we don't flinch that there's papers on, you know, Jediism and Discordianism and computer
awesome
games.
It'd be awesome if somebody just did Islam in 20 minutes.
Yeah,
that'd
yeah.
be wicked.
Yeah,
that would be really great thing.
That'd be quite.
In fact, the entire audience would go, "Man, I didn't know that."
Yeah,
there are five pillars.
Five pillars?
What are you talking about? This whole what?
So it's not Jesus.
There's five.
What are these five pillars?
Hang on, wait a minute. Are you telling me that Jesus was in the Quran? You know?
So it's not all violence.
What?
But Jurgen's mother told me it was. And there are women.
There are
this is remarkable.
It's actually really funny. That
any questions? A
whole room of people with their jaws open.
Okay.
Welcome to trying to present atheism to a room of people.
Let's Chris, you're going to say something
like that? Yeah, I don't think there's any problem with, you know, you've got to earn your bread and butter, as it were. So the departments have to get students in. Students want to study a certain amount of stuff. You give them what they want, but you don't just say, here's some facts. You say, here's some constructed facts, and here's a bit more of the stuff that you could get if you stayed on and did this to a higher level. And then that gives you the funding and the money to continue the research that you're doing, to continue degrees at a higher level. I think that's what all departments do, in a way.
If you're fond of saying, Chris, boom.
Sorry. It's sort of the academic process. Don't we always just sort of begin with, this is what so-and-so said, and let me tell you why it's either right or wrong? Isn't that sort of the process in general?
Mm-hmm. So, absolutely.
We're not going to.
No.
Kevin's going to say something we're all going to hate and say.
Okay. No, I'm looking.
I wasn't waiting.
Okay, in that case, but my point is perhaps this, in terms of the credibility question and the shifting emphasis of what sort of work we're supposed to be doing, because fair enough, we have the simplified version which we give to the students and we go through it, it's all boring and it's drudgery for us, but we do it because we then get to do the interesting stuff, which is what we do at conferences when we pick up on some really specific aspect, like there's this one word and we'll have an entire 20-minute paper on just one word, basically. And we do have papers. And that's because that's what interests us. We're the topics that we talk about at conferences are the ones that interest us, not necessarily. Okay, David is going to correct me.
I'm going to disagree with you. When I'm at conferences and I give my paper, I mean, a lot of that is very familiar to me. It's not the actual meat of the stuff I'm talking about. But I like teaching. I'm not doing teaching drudgery. I enjoy it. I enjoy talking about the basic stuff and tying that to the larger questions that I have.
I was kind of referring to what Ethan was saying.
No, that's fine. It's absolutely fine, but it is a conception that a lot of people have.
Yeah.
It isn't me. So, I don't think it's everybody. Mm-hmm. I don't really have a problem teaching a class on New Testament or.
But the question I'd pose to you then is: you enjoy it. It's great that we all presumably enjoy teaching the classes and so on and so forth. But we also get to enjoy doing the slightly more technical stuff, what you call the meat of your own work, which you don't necessarily get to speak about.
But I don't get to present that at conferences either, because every time I start talking about my stuff, I've got 15 minutes of definitions and set the scene to get through, which I can finally make a small analytical point at the end, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when I'm teaching, I don't have to do all that sort of definition and stuff to quite the same degree. I usually have more time, and I've got people who are perhaps more enthused about it, and I can talk around the more interesting theoretical questions to a greater degree, I find.
Even if you're giving a theory paper, you have to spend a lot of time, you know, explaining what these theorists argued, because not everybody knows before you can actually make your own points and make more.
It does depend on your field. I mean, if you're in an unusual field, I mean, every time I do a talk, I cannot assume that anybody there is going to have the background.
I have the same.
I mean, unless Kevin or Beth's there, I'm going to have.
See, I have the exact same problem that everyone implicitly knows what atheism is until I start talking about it. They're like, "Holy crap! I had no idea there's like an actual history to it. This is insane." It's so simple. Yeah, it's really not, you know.
I think when Jonathan was saying conference papers, you didn't want to get bogged down in, you know, you do the teaching and then you do conference papers.
Yeah.
I think conference papers was an example of the other things that we do with our research. So you could have said writing journal articles or writing your thesis or something there.
And my point is that with the shift in credibility, are we going to lose the opportunity to do that sort of stuff? If you think, like, particularly, if the emphasis becomes more and more upon the undergrads and the amount of money that an undergrad can bring into you for your department.
If we end up teaching the undergrads too much, we'll not actually be doing any thinking.
No. Was that you? No. Not the actual teaching itself. I'm referring more to the fact that there's a shifting emphasis on the public access focus of doing religious studies, in which we don't get to do the slightly more technical stuff that we do, potentially in conference papers, but also in our theses and journal articles. So, in that shifting of focus, are we going to lose the opportunity to do that more technical work?
I've never felt that
yeah.
way.
You could just be saying that about any discipline. You could,
yeah, if I'm not saying this is a religious study. Yeah. Problem.
No. So basically, you know, just to, as I tried to simplify it before, you're sort of saying that if through the emphasis being on us producing public benefit and through you know, teaching, say, fact files that make good citizens, will we not have any time to do research anymore? Mm. Maybe you'll have to spend more time preparing, say, interesting interviews on the BBC. It'd be fantastic if they actually got the study scholars on the BBC.
Yeah, it would be good.
Yeah. If you're listening, hire Chris and I as producers.
Yeah, very good.
I was just going to say, in terms of credibility, I mean, at least internally speaking, you know, that's already gone beyond the certainly the simplistic world religions paradigm. I mean, we don't bat an eyelid about the fact that there's papers about, you know, Jediism, paganism, discordianism, whatever, or atheism even.
Some people do.
Some people do. No, I know we don't, but the point is that, you know, for example, like, some religion journalists, they find these kind of things utterly ridiculous, but in academia we don't find that ridiculous at all. And I think that our only credibility, the only sort of mark of credibility is, can you, are you doing good social scientific work? Can you vaguely link it to religion? I mean, and even some of the papers at the conference, I don't think they even tried to link it to religion, and that was still okay because it was still good, credible social scientific work.
Yeah, but if you
work.
Think about it, you've just said, you know, the journalists and the people out there. This is the kind of credibility I'm talking about, because in a certain sense, it's the people out there who are determining whether money actually comes in to us. So within our little circle, yes, no, what we're doing is very credible and it's all very social scientific and it meets all the criteria and ticks all the boxes. But as far as the people out there are concerned, and they're the people who are giving us the money to do what we're doing right now, they're going to have a different opinion on that matter.
I've argued that we do sometimes need to meet people halfway, but for the most part, we also do need to stick up for ourselves and stick up for what we're doing. You know, we do have to emphasise to them, look, of course, non-religion and atheism are important topics for religious studies, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We do need to stick up for what we are actually doing, I think. Yeah.
But then there's, and I'm not actually jumping in about the non-religion thing, but there's an idea of, you know, yeah, the public have a perception of what we do, but like higher level academic work does tend to, you know, seep into public discourse eventually. My example would be, say, the idea of paradigm shifts. Before Thomas Kuhn, had anyone talked about a paradigm shift before? I don't know. But now that it's just so common parlance, you know, everyone, you know, people just say paradigm shift.
Phobias or Eliade.
anything, like everyone's an expert on Freud now, apparently.
Yes.
In all the sitcoms and all that.
Yes, but, you
know, which is all psychologists.
Do any of those people actually know what a paradigm shift is?
No,
not really.
But I guess
not personally. This is an example I've said many times. The way that people use phobias is completely wrong. It's not phobias. Mm-hmm. A phobia is an irrational fear. You don't have a phobia of dogs because you got bitten by a dog as a child. That's just a fear. It's perfectly rational.
But
a phobia is when it's irrational. You're afraid of sharks because your dad used to show you.
But what I'm saying is that's just a common feature.
Yeah.
I could do.
Like, yeah, those are engrams, David.
But take it to, you know, not wider than that. My point would be that the higher level stuff eventually, you know, will change, you know, that the world religions paradigm or whatever might be there now, but let's see 40, 50 years from now, if the discipline still exists or whatever, will things have moved on? Will public perception have moved on? I think it probably will have, given the amount of...
How will they know if the... how will these people know about that if the BBC isn't saying that this new study came out today that Jonathan Tuckett wrote about video games? I mean,
But
will that get out there?
No, it will get out there when some kid in the South shoots his grandmother in the back of the head because he's playing Grand Theft Auto. Then they'll say, okay, well, we need an expert who can talk about video games. Okay, let's find an expert. Oh, the local university.
We couldn't find one, but we found
the other thing. No, that's actually a very good point about this whole public benefit thing, because there happens to be a book, it's Grand Theft Childhood. And if you look at the publicizing, it's standard social scientific research. But when you look at the publicization of the book, it's do video games make children more violent?
Yeah.
Plus, and they added in the tagline, and what you can do about it. The publishing company actually went and made the authors add extra comments in so that the book was more marketable to a general audience that was sharing that fear.
See, this is also another issue, and my wife Andrea just started a master's degree anyway. She was reading a text today that was written by an expert, and that's basically citing Wikipedia and the History Channel. Oh, so we kind of have to like compete with that as well, because there's easily accessible textbooks on, because she's specifically looking at food and history.
And people are always going to buy more of those than they do academic books.
Than our academic books. So do we have to change our academic writing?
Right.
To appeal to a broader audience.
It's not. We should just all go on mainstream. Go on mainstream US TV and shout about how many degrees we've got.
Yes.
Well, yeah. Right. Well, exactly. Because people are more interested in Reza Aslan.
Because I'm an expert in the field.
But that's not going to change. No matter how cool we write,
we should get involved in that a bit more. You know, we could maybe all every week meet up and like edit Wikipedia. We could pick a Wikipedia article. Right, let's take it to pieces.
Common balance. Let's occupy academia.
But yeah, so you just sit around and
I occupy academia.
But there's a bizarre fear of writing popular book. Well, maybe there is.
No, it's because there's very few people who are successful at it.
Well, it is
for good reasons.
I'm giving serious thought to doing that, to writing two versions. Publishing my PhD and then doing another version of it that takes a more sort of journalistic.
But still, more people are going to read David Wilcock's book than are going to read your book.
Well, but what I find interesting is that you're going to write two versions of the book.
Uh-huh.
Whereas, you know, you'll have academics who have written a book, and other academics will read this book thinking, this fellow academic has published a book. They will read it and think, what is this? This isn't proper academia, because they don't appreciate, you know, that I have written this book for the general audience. Whereas in your case, you've very cleverly said, I'm going to have two books. I'm going to have the academic-friendly book, and then I'm going to have the public-friendly book.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see how people respond.
Well, I think that's actually a good choice of words, because I think sometimes academics get a bit kind of uncomfortable if it's too populist, just as much as the public gets.
Does that lose credibility? That's the thing. When you have an academic text that becomes very popular and is purchased widely, does that then kind of destroy the credibility?
I'm pitching more a sort of John Ronson or what's the Lipstick Traces? Who's that by Greil Marcus? These aren't stupid books. Yeah, they're not dumbed down or populist. No. They just don't have the same need to define everything and produce 20 sources.
Steven Pinker, Jesse Barry.
Yeah. There's lots of good examples. Yeah,
Prothero. But I'll also add in there that texts on atheism are horribly written.
I'm sure
you get
they
Victor
are.
Stenger coming in thinking
of course
he's going to write the
horribly
next
written because they're written
book.
By it's atheists. People who have no moral compass whatsoever. They hate God.
They
are doing everything for their own personal gain.
Babies, you know, they're
but
just.
It's also, they're also written by physicists in his case.
I could go on and on about that.
But I think it's maybe an illusion, you know, the idea that if your book is popular, then it loses credibility. It's maybe more of an academic, like a problem within academia.
Within academia, yeah.
And I think it's also within people's heads, within.
There's a self-inflicted kind of desire to be quite elitist. I think in the discipline itself, you don't want to do anything that might be overly simplistic or popular.
Well,
I don't quite understand why.
There's a sense of jealousy.
Yeah,
we're very critical and we don't tend to like.
I see it more as a territorialism. I don't think it's necessarily out of any sort of egotistical drive. It might be quite the opposite, a sort of desire to protect, you know.
I think that's partly true. Also, I think probably most academics aren't good popular writers.
Yeah,
that's right. Spend too much time writing academic.
Or aren't good writers.
Happy to sign the ivory tower for 20 years.
You don't have to be a good writer to write it as long as you are thorough. And
most academics aren't good writers, let's face it.
Uh-huh.
They're good academic writers, but not necessarily.
Or they might not even be good academic writers, they just do good academic work, and so we let it slide by.
Actually, I mean, to find a piece of solid research that is very well written is quite unusual, and they're often the most successful books. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of examples, but I mean, you could take Hutton's work, for instance, is very readable, but it's solid research as well.
Yeah, but I mean, even, for example, like, the fact is that academics, even when they're going to seeing a paper about something they don't know anything about, they still prefer a paper which tries to be engaging the audience, has some respect for the audience, has examples, has, you know, a bit that's a bit juicy, you know, that kind of thing. Sorry.
But I don't even have to do any theory in mine. Just go in and show people pictures of reptiles.
Exactly.
Now,
cool. I was thinking of, you know, I was trying to think of a couple of popular works that there, and two names came to mind, were like Bruno Latour and Emile Durkheim, both came to mind.
Because they're so popular.
Emile Durkheim!
I mean, they're very popular within academia, but they've been through translation, and I wonder how much is down to, you know, there's a translator who's taken their work, A, translated it into a different language, but B, you know, sort of translated the ideas a bit more, and maybe an analogy could be made that there could be a market for academic translation, even within, say, English to English, but someone taking...
Latour is a beautiful writer. He's a really, really good writer. I don't have a clue what he says in most of his books. His most recent one particularly, I don't think it says anything that I can understand. But it's beautifully written.
Mm. But there's examples of the exact opposite, though, and sometimes in academia, it's, you know, the more obscure and the more actually horrendous to read it is, the more the better it probably is.
It's kind of the continental and analytical philosophy thing. I think a lot of the European religious studies scholars are less concerned with that sort of, you know, being careful to define everything, and it's
yeah.
And as a result, they write better.
Do they?
Sometimes they do.
You know, Peter Berger in the U.S.
He's a clear writer.
He's a very clear writer, but his books are very short and they don't really explain much.
Mm.
And he's very good at just saying.
Yeah, Peter Berger's writing is very similar to Latour's. Actually.
Yeah, he's got the background to say.
J.C. Smith's style is very
J.C. Smith is
casual.
Amazing as a writer. He's amazing, but like Latour, I have no idea what the hell he's saying until he gets to the end. He'll suddenly say his point. You're like, man, this metaphor.
Gears. Sorry to interrupt. And Geertz is actually quite a funny writer in the sense that he's actually really lyrical to read. Really
Clifford,
he doesn't always actually, you know, he could have been more clear and more kind of, but actually it's really beautiful to read, and, you know, it's like a, you know, some of his stuff on Balinese cockfight and even the stuff on religion as a cultural system, I think it's a beautiful piece of work.
Kind of drawing what we've just been discussing about the beauty of certain authors' writings back to this whole question of credibility, and we have our own little academic circle of credibility, and then we have the wider public credibility. Maybe the best way to compromise would be to, in a sense, teach academics how to write. And I know that sounds like a very arrogant thing to say, but I mean in the sense that we do have some authors who are very dense, so perhaps maybe the main problem we have as academics in appeasing the paymaster credibility kind of sphere of things is that we write things that they themselves can't read. So we need to think more and more in terms of how we can write in such a way that they can read it, not just that we can read it. Maybe that's a compromise.
And I think that's incredibly important, but I think it's always going to be a minimum of scholars who can and even less who are able to accomplish that, or who even want to.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps that should be more of a consideration in terms of who we're hiring and who we're promoting.
But, then you're going to cut off a lot of good scholarship.
Get back to the idea of marketing ourselves. If you look at the future of religious studies, it seems to be, even at the EASR, when they're presenting on, well, this is the basis of my dissertation, it's so sort of new and different. It's cool, if you will.
Mm.
To the point that yes, we're going to have to worry about writing it to a broader audience, but at the same time, I think it's going to be more marketable to a broader audience because it's not this sort of, I'm going to look at this tiny little aspect of this little Jewish sect, that's about it. Now it's, we're going to talk about aliens and reptilians and atheism and video games. There's a lot of that going around at the ASR.
Yeah, and there was some scholars who wrote books on 2012. I'm working on mine, but those didn't sell nearly as much as any of the other books about 2012.
And, yeah, it's true enough.
It's a huge popular topic. It's stuff that people want to know about, but they don't go and buy those books.
A little off topic, but is that because an academic text on 2012 doesn't have the sort of conspiratorial aspect to it?
I don't know.
A book written about 2012 saying, well, 2012 is a hidden conspiracy that the such and such, such and such, isn't that more interesting than, I'm just going to give you the bare bone facts of what it actually is. When you come along and talk about Bakhtoons, they're like, what the hell is this? I want to know about why the world's blowing up.
If you put the subtitle, the shocking truth behind the 2012 conspiracy, it really means,
it did help a bit, but a lot. I mean, the publishers, like University of Colorado Press, added some like subtitle to Anthony Avini's book to make it seem more interesting. They're like, but it, and they sold, but they're still minimally dispersed compared to the rest of the popular stuff about 2012.
Academics do have to do this sort of translation into more common parlance. When you're writing grant applications and all these things, you have to, and I think increasingly now, you're sort of having to justify your research in terms which others can understand. So there's a lot more of that, I think, going on. It's maybe not necessarily being disseminated or treated with much respect. You know, people are like, oh, I have to do this, you know, stupid bit of paperwork here. But actually, that's a very valuable exercise that we are all doing or going to be doing, I think, translating a bit. And maybe that process could be made a bit more.
Well, and I think it's especially important when we're doing new things, like looking at conspiracism or looking at popular millennialism. It's important to translate that to those sort of grant committees that look, because we're not as well established in looking at these things, so we do have to convince that what we're looking at is something actually viable and worthwhile.
Which is what Jonathan was talking about right at the beginning.
But it's a different, that's different when you're talking about making yourself credible to a grant committee and making yourself credible to the public.
Yeah. Okay, well, that sums that up nicely, I suppose.
Well, we came back to where we started.
It's some kind of an ending.
It's some kind of an ending, yeah. That was a good roundabout.
Round up the usual suspects.
Yeah.
Will people find this roundtable discussion credible? I don't know.
It's certainly going on my academia page.
Everything goes on your academia page. Rode the train.
I need to get one of those.
Academia page. Yeah.
As we were saying, we have kind of come full circle. So I guess it just remains for us to thank our panelists. We've had Kevin Whiteside, roundtable regular, Liam Sutherland, David Robertson, Chris Cotter, and myself, Ethan. No, I'm not.